This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of November 2020. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Coronavirus spreading again in Travis County and across the state of Texas.
We can get to the peak very quickly, and coming down from it can take months.
The big flop, why the Democrats' attempt to flip the Texas House failed.
I think that there was just a ceiling that was reached.
And KUT's promise to improve how it reflects the diversity of the community it serves.
Public media in general has long had a history of being, frankly, overwhelmingly white.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
Again, I appreciate the opportunity to update you and the court on our COVID-19 response. Unfortunately, this update looks a bit worse than it did last week.
Here's Austin's interim health authority speaking to Travis County Commissioner's Court this week.
New confirmed cases in Travis County. Yesterday, we reported 214 cases, which is the first time we had more than 200 cases since September the 10th.
Hospital admissions have more than doubled from their low of over a month ago. Over the past 10 days, the rate of increase has accelerated, although we still are low compared to where we were at the peak of the pandemic in July. We were at almost 500 hospitalizations. Right now, we're around 150. ICU admissions have more than doubled from the low of October 22nd. And Dr. Escott said they're considering lowering the ICU threshold at which they would up the risk-based guidelines from stage 3, where we are now, to stage 4. Let's hear this extended clip from Escott, because this is important stuff.
There's lots of space in hospitals. There's lots of equipment. We have more ventilators locally than we anticipate we would ever need. But we don't have the people. So where are those people now? Why can't we get those people? Because those people are El Paso, and those people are in Lubbock and Amarillo and Dallas. They're in other states around the country who are facing substantial surge already. So our concern right now is that we will not be able to have appropriate staff for 350 beds. It will probably be more like 200 beds. So it's likely that we are going to have to revise down our threshold for stage 4. We're looking at that information. We're going to have some further discussions about that. But my concern is in the next week to 2 weeks that we may need to transition into stage 4 so that we can flatten the curve again. Where we are right now is very similar to where we were around June the 17th, June the 18th, when we were 2 weeks away from hitting our peak. So if we flatten things out, if we can decrease this amplitude of this curve and spread this disease out over a longer period of time and bring the numbers back down, we'll be in a much better place for Thanksgiving and Christmas. If we don't do that, if we don't make changes now, if we don't increase our vigilance as a community right now, then Thanksgiving is going to look bad and Christmas may look worse. As we saw with our first surge, we can get to the peak very quickly, and coming down from it can take months. So 3 weeks up and 3 months down is what happened last time.
Stage 4, among other things, includes a recommendation that people avoid non-essential travel. Now, Texas this week became the first state in the nation to reach a cumulative 1 million coronavirus cases. This is, of course, since the pandemic began. We're above 1 million cases now. So Texas Public Radio reporter Bonnie Petrie spoke about this statewide situation with NPR's Audie Cornish.
Bonnie, why are the coronavirus numbers so large in Texas?
Yeah, so one out of every 10 confirmed coronavirus infections in the United States right now is here in Texas. Now, that's slightly higher than the proportion, the Texas percentage of the U.S. population, and it is bad right now. In El Paso in West Texas, it's seeing a massive surge in cases. Hospitals have been overwhelmed by sick patients pouring into ERs, and local officials there have had to bring in 4 mobile morgues to deal with deaths. But it's not just an urban problem. Smaller towns and communities all across Texas are getting hit hard, too.
What are local and state officials trying to do to get the infection rate under control?
Well, see, this is the problem. Let's take El Paso, for instance. The top elected official in that county shut down businesses 2 weeks ago because of the surge, and immediately it angered the governor and the state attorney general, who sued over that. And that sort of conflicting guidance doesn't help matters. So instead of the state swooping in to help get infections under control, the opposite happened. It was the state demanding that everything go back to normal, which was causing these infections to spike to begin with.
Is there any precaution that has worked up until this point?
Yeah, we had a big summer surge, if you recall, in July, and mask mandates did help. Closing businesses like bars and limiting the numbers of customers in theaters and gyms, a way to break the chain of transmission, that helped too. It worked. We saw here in Texas that big summer surge of cases was brought under control. But, and this is big, people then got comfortable. They stopped paying attention to the guidelines, and, you know, there you go. When restrictions eased, the virus gets an opening, and pop, the case count zoom up again.
Can you give us more detail about what's going on in the rural parts of Texas?
Sure. So part of the problem there in these more isolated rural areas is that it seems to be a lot more information is going around about the virus and how to fight it. For instance, in a rural place like Kerr County, there's been a lot of pushback on mask mandates. It's often framed in these areas as an issue of freedom and liberty. A doctor there, Will Rector, though, says that's not really a fair comparison.
Well, there are many instances where our personal liberties have been impugned because of greater good. Wearing a seatbelt is one. Driving the speed limit is one. Placing a child in a child carrier in a vehicle. Those are all things that are against our personal liberties, but we do them because we realize that they save lives.
Right. So his point there that is that if more people get on board with wearing masks and other limitations, a little bit of curbed liberty now creates more freedom in the future because it ends up saving lives.
Texas Public Radio reporter Bonnie Petrie speaking with NPR's Audie Cornish. Work on I-35 that could reshape parts of downtown Austin is being laid out for the public to comment on, but only for a month. KUT's Samuel King reports on the upcoming I-35 Capital Express project.
The project would add 2 managed high-occupancy vehicle lanes in each direction to I-35 between U.S. 290 East and Ben White Boulevard. TxDOT's Diane Hodges says they're unveiling 3 proposed alternatives, all of which would get rid of 35's upper deck in central Austin.
2 of the concepts would call for basically all of the lanes, the managed lanes and the main lanes, to be lowered through downtown. And 1 of them actually calls for the managed lanes to be tunneled beneath the main lanes.
Hodges says HOV lanes will also be added to I-35 north of U.S. 290 East and south of Ben White. They hope to have those projects completed before work begins downtown in a few years. People can see the renderings and leave comments at mobility35openhouse.com through December 12th. Samuel King, KUT News.
The Austin City Council took the first steps this week in approving a fee that would help pay for transportation infrastructure created by new homes and businesses. The fee would be based on how much traffic a new development is expected to create. Councilmember Ann Kitchen says the proposal is a way to offset the costs that even needed developments provide.
If a housing development is not paying those fees or those costs, then the rest of the community has to pick those up in some way in order to address the impact on our street infrastructure.
More debate is to come on the proposal, and a final approval could happen as soon as next month. but there would be a year-long grace period before any of the fees would be collected. The Central Texas drought situation got worse over the past week. All of Travis and Hays counties are now classified as being in moderate drought. Parts of Williamson and Bastrop counties are in states of severe drought. It's because of this La Nina weather pattern, keeping rain away at a time of year when there's usually a lot more of it. So we talked about this a bit last week. Well, KUT's actually Lopez talked about it, but now we're going to take a closer look and hear from some other people on the issue of why Texas Democrats failed to flip enough seats in the Texas House this year to win a majority in the chamber. So here's Ashley.
For Democrats, this was a pretty big blow. For decades, Republicans have had control of everything, the governorship, the state Senate, and the state House. And they thought things might change this year, mostly because they made serious inroads in Republican-held state House districts within suburban counties in 2018. That year, Democrats flipped 12 seats in the Texas House, mostly in districts with changing demographics in the suburbs. They found 9 more seats that fit that model, and they thought flipping them shouldn't really be that hard.
I think that there was just a ceiling that was reached.
That's Victoria DeFrancesco Soto with the Center for Politics and Governance at the LBJ School at UT Austin. She says Democrats got pretty close in a lot of those 9 seats, but it just wasn't enough. She says mostly this was a taller order than Democrats wanted to admit to themselves.
The way a district is drawn impacts the outcome. And these were districts that were drawn in 2010 on the wake of the Tea Party revolution, the takeover in 2010. So institutionally, they were structured to benefit Republicans.
She says it's really hard to overcome a structural advantage like that. Plus, Jim Henson, who's a pollster and directs the Texas Politics Project at UT Austin, says Democrats mostly just underestimated Republicans. They underestimated how many voters they still have in the suburbs, and they underestimated the work Republicans did after those losses in 2018.
You know, we saw a lot of reaction among Republican office holders in the legislature to Democratic gains and narrow Republican losses in 2019. And that carried through to the election in a way that I think, was widely underestimated in its impact.
In the 2019 legislative session, Republicans worked with Democrats on issues like education and property taxes, things both sides could find some common ground on. And it turns out voters noticed. And Luke Macias, who is a political consultant for some of the most conservative members of the Texas House, says he thinks the fact that Republicans got rid of straight ticket voting for this election really helped a lot of those Texas House members in those suburbs where Democrats were making gains because of Donald Trump.
That was a huge negative for Democrats who were hoping that anybody who opposed Donald Trump in an urban suburban district would automatically say the Democrats should rule, right? And we're seeing, even in areas that were not fond of the president, you still saw them keeping their Republican legislator in power.
Macias says it also didn't help Democrats that Republicans did better with Latinos in this election than they did in 2016 and 2018.
This is not only good for a sitting state representative who has Hispanic voters, but it's very good for the entire Republican Party who is trying to look at what our path forward is to maintain control of this state.
And the fact that Republicans seem to have done better with Latino voters this time is something that Jim Henson says should act as a wake-up call for Texas Democrats. For a long time, the working theory has been that the state will become more Democratic as the state becomes more racially diverse. For example, if more Latinos vote in those suburbs, they will likely vote for Democrats and Democrats will win more races. But Henson says it's been obvious for a long time that it's not that easy.
You know, the evidence has been right there in front of everybody that, you know, Republicans have been getting 30 to 40% of the Hispanic vote for 2 decades.
Henson says we don't know enough about Latino turnout yet to say exactly where the weak spots were for Democrats. But Victoria DeFrancesco Soto says Democrats also weren't able to do a lot of the groundwork and person-to-person mobilization that they usually do because of the pandemic. She says that's another structural thing that just didn't work in the Democrats' favor. But she says this doesn't mean it's all over and Democrats should just accept that this will always be a state run by Republicans.
Politics is a long game. And, you know, 4 years ago, 8 years ago, these suburban districts were completely out of reach. So the fact that you did have the margins that you had with many of these races is maybe a present loss, but in the long term, it's building space for Democrats to recruit stronger candidates and maybe clinch those seats.
And Luke Mejia says the 2018 election, particularly the really close U.S. Senate race between Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke, showed him Republicans should be running elections like they could lose them.
There's no doubt that Texas is a state that can become competitive at any election cycle. And Beto O'Rourke proved that.
And it's not like the gap between Republicans and Democrats in races isn't narrowing. Many of these state house races were lost by a couple percentage points. Plus, statewide, things are changing. In 2012, Mitt Romney won the state by almost 16 percentage points. In 2016, Donald Trump won it by 9. This year, he only won it by 6. Jim Henson says that's progress.
There's a line there. It just doesn't fit very, you know, dramatically in the frame of Texas changing colors or turning blue.
And most importantly, Victoria DeFrancesco Soto says, more Texans voted this year than ever before. And that's especially impressive because there was a pandemic.
So I think that is important from just a civic engagement perspective, because we know that once people vote, they're more likely to vote again.
She says, in the scheme of things, that's a big win too. And as far as how Democrats see all this, in a statement last week, the party said, quote, "While we achieved some goals in the election and came up short on others, we have marched forward in Texas. The slow pace of change might be disappointing at times. However, over years, it is meaningful and will lead to real help for the people who need us," end quote. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
The Austin Police Department is facing yet another lawsuit over its use of less lethal rounds during protests over the summer. KUT's Andrew Weber tells us this is the second lawsuit against the department this week.
The complaint follows a similar one out earlier this week. It alleges excessive use of force on the part of APD for using crowd control ammunition that's marketed as less lethal because the projectiles can seriously injure people targeted by them. APD officers fired the rounds at Austinites protesting police violence over the summer. The lawsuit was filed in federal court Tuesday on behalf of Stephen Aron, who attended a protest near I-35 on May 30th. He was acting as an unofficial medic when he was hit with a so-called beanbag round, which is filled with lead or silica-based birdshot. Aron says the projectile struck him near his hand and wrist, and that he hasn't had full range of motion since the incident. It's one of at least four similar lawsuits filed against the department. APD has since said that it won't use the rounds for crowd control, but the department has restocked much of its cash despite community concerns. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
The city of Austin signed off on $1 million contract with a company to audit the police department. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey has that.
This audit's been nearly a year in the making. In 2019, the city began investigating anonymous complaints that an assistant police chief had used a derogatory term for Black people. A month later, last December, the council voted to do a far-reaching investigation into racism and bigotry at the police department, including an assessment of how cadets are trained and how officers are promoted within the department. Now, council members are awarding New York City-based Kroll Associates up to $1.3 million to do this audit. When the council voted last year, they said they wanted the findings back by December 2021. It's unclear if that timeline has changed because of the pandemic. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
The city of Austin is going to lease another hotel for people who otherwise could not safely isolate themselves after testing positive for the coronavirus. So the Austin City Council members approved at their meeting on Thursday a more than $900,000 agreement with the Fairfield Inn on Research Boulevard. The hotel is going to serve as an isolation facility. They have 84 rooms reserved for that purpose. The lease has an initial term of 60 days that can extend it another three months if they need to. The property will offset the December closure of two hotels that have been used in a similar way. These facilities have been paid for with federal relief money, and that relief money expires at the end of the year. So this week, KUT and KUTX posted a letter to our listeners on the station's efforts to do a better job reflecting the diversity of our audience. The letter was released as part of a new nationwide effort called Public Media for All. This is a campaign across the country asking public media organizations to reflect on their lack of diversity, their lack of inclusion. So in the KUT letter, in the KUTX letter, the stations acknowledged our own poor track record on race and how the station plans to change things going forward. KUT's Nadia Hamdan spoke with KUT and KUTX director and general manager Debbie Hyatt about why she decided to write the letter and what she hopes to achieve.
Public media in general has long had a history of being, frankly, overwhelmingly white. And at KUT, there's been that history, and there's also been a history of people of color feeling uncomfortable about the organization and having experiences within the organization that, you know, did not reflect their culture and, frankly, were not good experiences. And so it felt important to us not only to talk about what we wanted to do going forward, but also to acknowledge that there is a history there, both a station history and an overall public media history that really makes this even more urgent for us to do this kind of an effort.
Let's talk about that. What led up to this? Like you just said, and in your letter, you talk about colleagues of color feeling uncomfortable and having negative experiences at the station. Can you be more specific on how KUT failed here?
Sure. You know, we have had people in the past that have said things that, you know, I certainly would have considered, you know, objectionable, offensive. And, you know, I think that that's something that should never be happening in any newsroom or, frankly, any workplace. I also think that there were people in some leadership roles that frankly, led in a way that was punitive to people. And that's not something any organization should have. There were times when we did not have enough colleagues of color, and I feel like we still don't, to really reflect the community. And I think that the people that were within the organization at times felt very isolated, and also felt like perhaps their ideas and their views were dismissed. And, you know, what that meant, two things. It made it an uncomfortable workplace for them, but it also meant that for our audience that they did not benefit from those diverse voices.
And I think it's important to point out that this isn't the first time KUT's issues have been laid out publicly. There's been local news coverage, social media callouts from former employees. And KUT had even hired an independent reporter and editor to investigate the allegations of workplace hostility. But the stories published in 2018 were quickly taken down with no explanation as to why. I know much of this occurred before you became general manager, but as the current leader of this station, can you tell us now whether or not those stories will be republished?
You know, that is something we're looking into. KUT received legal advice on those. And, you know, the decisions apparently at the time were made based on that legal advice. The executive editor, Teresa Frontato, is taking a close look at that now. As, you know, as the general manager, I don't have a role in making the decisions about what is or isn't published or aired. But, you know, we have been having the conversations about what, you know, what does she need to review and what does she need to know in order to make those decisions?
And do you feel we've been transparent enough to our community?
You know, I think that there are times when, in the past, when certainly KUT has not been transparent enough. As a 30-year journalist myself, the notion that anything was ever unpublished from the website is disturbing to me. But I think that we want to make changes. We want to make sure that there is a really strong editorial integrity process in place, that the newsroom is making decisions that are based on what the audience needs to know. And, you know, that's part of what we've been working on for the past 18 months, and it's what we're going to keep working on.
You know, oftentimes when we hear these conversations about organizational change, we can sometimes lose sight of the fact that we're talking about people, specifically people of color, who feel they've been mistreated and boxed out. You know, I'm curious, what have you learned from people of color about their experience working at KUT and KUTX?
You know, one of the things I've done is I've gone back and talked to everyone, of course, here at the station about things that occurred in the past. But I also reached out to some people who had left the station to kind of get a sense of those experiences. And I think the overwhelming concern was that at times their ideas and views were dismissed. And, you know, like I said, not only is that bad in terms of a workplace, but it also means that the audience doesn't benefit from a lot of different ideas and a lot of different life experiences that are important to what goes into understanding our community.
And how much should, you know, how KUT looks on the inside matter to our listeners? You know, in other words, how should our health as a diverse newsroom be reflected in the stories we cover?
You know, I think that what it means is that at times there are complex stories that because we become more diverse, we'll do a better job of covering. You know, a great example that's been talked about a lot recently in the media and elsewhere is the whole notion of the Black Latino vote in the most recent election. You know, newsrooms that have come to value diversity and those diverse voices and really listened to all of the different life experiences of the teams that they have done a much better job of explaining that, you know, Latino vote was never a block. It's a lot of different communities and a lot of different viewpoints. And so I think that's what we're talking about. You know, when I talk about diversity in the context of a newsroom, I'm talking about better coverage, because the more that we can reflect the community, the more that we can understand the community, the better a job we're going to do covering the whole community.
Obviously, you've put out this letter, and with it, the KUT and KUTX leadership team has put together a list of ways you all plan to, quote, improve diversity, equity, and inclusion, unquote. Can you share some of those with us?
Sure. You know, the first thing I want to do, though, is clarify that this, you know, this wasn't a list that the leadership team put together as much as it was a list that came from, you know, talking within the organization about what are the needs and where are our gaps and what are the things we really need to work on. You know, we had a lot of departmental meetings and some all-staff meetings to kind of recognize these areas. Some of the things that we're talking about is, you know, how can we be better in our coverage in listening to the community? The newsroom has come up with a plan, you know, talking about reaching out and holding some community engagement efforts. On the music side, the music team decided to, you know, come up with some goals around making sure that more diverse voices, people of color, other types of music are included within the music that we play on KUTX. In terms of what we do within the organization, you know, we had a lot of conversation about how we hire and what that process is like. And, you know, managers talked about, you know, how we can make it better. We also talked with, you know, staff members about that. So we laid out a new recruiting and hiring process as well.
And do you have anything in place, any accountability measures to hold yourselves, hold ourselves accountable to follow through with these promises?
Yeah, I mean, we tried as much as possible to put very specific dates around things. And also, frankly, the biggest accountability measure we feel was to be, you know, transparent and share all of this action plan with our listeners, because I expect that, you know, the community will help hold us all accountable within the organization. I expect that my team, the whole staff, will help hold me accountable and the other leaders accountable. You know, part of the reason for launching it all in this way is to make sure everyone knows it's there. And so, you know, everyone knows when we're failing and everyone knows when we're making progress on things.
KUT is not the only media organization confronting how it treats people of color. We're seeing this happen across the industry. Why do you think it's so important for media organizations to hold themselves accountable in this way?
You know, we take great pride as media organizations in our role in holding others accountable. You know, it is the whole community watchdog role, the whole notion that what we do matters in terms of, you know, making sure that people know what's going on elsewhere. It's hypocritical not to turn that lens on ourselves.
Debbie Hyatt is Director and General Manager of KUT and KUTX. Debbie, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Nadia.
KUT is also looking for your feedback on how to increase our outreach throughout communities of color in Central Texas. You can find our survey online at KUT.org.
That is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of November 2020. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org or just ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶